Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,500 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Jessica Mann, author of the new book, Uplift. Born high in a spruce tree, Columbina and her brothers grow up listening to ancestral tales through long winters and harvesting pine seeds in the summer. But Columbina begins to question her clan's traditions and forms bonds with creatures beyond her species. When she uncovers a looming threat from the mysterious Tall Ones, she must decide how far she'll go to protect her world. This richly imaginative novel, told through avian eyes, Uplift explores the strength of community, the power of interconnection, and the impact of environmental change. Uplift is a rich mythical story told through non-human eyes about the bonds of family and the joys of friendship. It may just change the way you see birds forever. Jessica Mann was founder and CEO of Green Futures Unlimited, a sustainability consulting firm providing solutions for Fortune 500 companies. She also taught with the University of California, San Diego Extension. Jessica served as Director of Environmental Health and Safety for Pfizer, Inc., where she founded the La Jolla, California site Sustainability and Green Chemistry Program and was honored with a Pfizer Achievement Award. Jessica holds MPH from the School of Public Health and a Bachelor of Science from the School for Environment and Sustainability, both from the University of Michigan. For more information, you can visit Jessica's website, which is jessicamann.org. That's Jessica, MANN.org. Okay, with that, I'd like to welcome Jessica to the show. Good day, Jessica.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Robert, and thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. I enjoy reading a novel that's novel, you know, that's very different and unique. So, this is Bringing Inspiration to Earth. So I'm always interested in the inspiration behind an author's book. So what inspired you to write Uplift?
Well, I have always loved animals and nature. I mean, that's kind of been my bedrock since I was a kid, and I have to thank my parents for that because they were wonderful, and our whole family was always outdoors. They'd take us out to Wyoming every summer, and we would go hiking and camping and boating, and so I just love the outdoors. That's just really a deep thing for me. And so, you know, as a writer, I was thinking about sort of how to incorporate that into my book, and I wondered, maybe people might pay more attention and care about animals if they could, you know, sort of see through their eyes. And so, you know, that would kind of let them widen their circle of interest to others by seeing through those other eyes. So that was my inspiration, was really to give nature a voice.
Yeah. And one of the things I like about the book is seeing it through the eyes, like the main character, Columbina, is am I pronouncing that correct? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. When she finally, you know, cracks out of that shell, you know, and you describe the movement of the birds. I mean, it is so much like what many people will have seen, you know, as birds, you know, crack through their shell and born. I mean, and, you know, it's seeing it through their eyes is like, you know, like she had this brightness even through, you know, her eyes, her eyelids, you know, and waving her head back and forth. I mean, you know, kind of looking for the, you know, the food. I mean, those are very, you know, common kind of behaviors one would see.
Yeah, yeah. I really tried to, throughout the whole book, I did a lot of research because I wanted the animals and the birds all to be realistic. You know, I didn't want to write a cartoon book. I wanted these to be mm-hmm. real beings and as based as much as possible on their real lives and behaviors. So that was a lot of fun for me, actually.
Yeah, I bet it was. Now, let's take a little bit of time, you know, to talk about the characters, you know, the development of them and the, you know, the selection that you made as far as who the characters would be in this book. Let's start with the white bark pine. You know, that, I mean, you have characters, but you also have a pine tree. So tell us, you know, why that particular pine, you know, and why even have that as part of the story?
So that's a great question because a lot of people say, why did you write about pine tree? How do you get into the head of a pine tree? So I chose the pine and the Clark's Nutcracker together because they have this really unique relationship in the high Rocky Mountains of the American West, whereby the tree needs the bird and the bird needs the tree. It's an example of something called mutualism in nature. So, and these trees are incredible. The white bark pine, so Albrea is, she's 1,000 years old, and they're usually twisted and gnarled trees, and they live in some of the highest places up in the mountains, just places where other trees can't even live. And they have these cones with seeds in them that are, I mean, they're sort of the equivalent of chocolate for us. These seeds are so rich in fats and proteins and all this good nutrition for animals. And the seeds are kind of locked within these really tight pine cones. And so pretty much one of the only animals that is able to open these cones is the Clark's Nutcracker, because they have just incredible sharp bills that can, you know, just they peck at them like daggers almost to open them. And so, you know, so the trees really need the nutcrackers to carry their seeds far and wide to spread the trees. And then the nutcrackers, so it's a Clark's Nutcracker, they're beautiful birds. They're mostly silver, and then they've got large patches of black and white. Just beautiful to see. And they're very gregarious. You always hear them chattering up in the trees. And they're highly intelligent. They're part of the corvid family of birds. So highly intelligent and also very social. They live together in big groups, intergenerational. So the kids stick around to help the parents with the next, you know, batch of chicks coming out. So it just seemed like a great, you know, being intelligent and social, I mean, that's like us, right? That's like mm-hmm. people. And so I just thought this would be a great way for people to sort of relate to these birds and, you know, sort of get into their heads, you know, up in these mountains.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's a wonderful way of stressing the interconnectedness of various aspects of nature.
Exactly, exactly. That was an important wish so that people will understand.
Yeah. Now, you also chose a calliope hummingbird named Calliope. so tell us about Calliope.
Oh, Calliope's a great little character. So, you know, these hummingbirds are, I mean, they're like 3 inches long. They're tiny, and yet they can fly, and they every year they will migrate 5,000 miles. I mean, they're flying, imagine that, on these little tiny wings. So they are fierce little birds, and they're also fierce in personality too. They are very territorial. I mean, they will go after hawks and other larger birds, you know, who are in their territory. They'll go after them. And they're just incredible flyers. And so for his character, Calliope, I made him kind of militaristic in that, you know, he's a fighter and he's got very sort of, I don't know what's the right word, you know, sort of old-fashioned ways of thinking, like, you know, this is the way things are and not really open to change. But yet then, as he befriends Columbina, who's such a, you know, a rebel and a change maker, he starts to learn from her and he sees the wisdom of some of what she's saying. And so he does change. So I thought that was a really interesting kind of evolution for him.
Yeah, that's good. I love hummingbirds. You know,
they're
just fascinating creatures.
Everybody loves hummingbirds.
Yeah. Now, you also had a belted kingfisher named Halcyon.
Mm-hmm.
And why Halcyon?
So they're just cool birds. I think they all like kingfishers too. And they live all over the world, including up in the high mountains. And the crazy thing about them is that they, you know, their name is Kingfisher. They fish. So they will hover over ponds and then they go into these headfirst dives and they stab fish underwater. I mean, that's a pretty incredible talent, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, you know, they're so interesting. They can see underwater and they're loud and kind of flashy. They're always chattering and rattling when you hear them. There's no mistaking that there's a kingfisher nearby. So he seemed like a, you know, sort of a good character he's jovial, kind of joking around a lot. Doesn't take himself too seriously, you know, whereas the Nutcrackers are sort of a proud clan and, you know, they sort of put themselves above others because of that intelligence. And so I thought he would be a good foil to them.
Yes. And it's wonderful because the characters really embody different archetypes, you know, that we find in the human population.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's Junius, the green darner dragonfly.
Mm-hmm. So he is a very interesting character. So dragonflies don't live very long. So they have a really interesting life cycle. They actually start their lives underwater as these nymphs. They look like these crazy sort of insects. And so they live there for a while, but then comes their turn to hatch into the air. And so they come up, they crawl up, and they hatch into the air. They unfold their wings, kind of like a butterfly, you know, the way they hatch from caterpillars, similar. And then once they're airborne, they're incredible flyers. I mean, they can fly, you know, up to 30 miles an hour. They can fly backwards and side to side. And they're just kind of the sort of the aerialists, the stars of the insect world with their wings. And they don't live for long. You know, once they're up above ground in the air, they live for maybe, you know, a couple of months. And so I just thought it was really interesting having a character in the book that would sort of be a contrast to Albrea, the white-barked pine, who's, you know, over 1,000 years old and has this perspective of life on Earth that goes back that far. Whereas Junius, you know, he's only got his weeks to live and to mate and to, you know, try to reproduce. And yet his character, I made him have sort of a dry wit and a pleasant, you know, sort of amiable character. He knows he's going to die, but yet he's content with his life because he feels like he's lived a full life.
Yeah, that really says a lot when you think about it. You know, the idea of contentment, not being tied to the length of a life, would really give one pause, you know, to recognize that, you know, I don't have to live long in order to be, you know, content or fulfilled.
Right. It's sort of about, you know, sort of seizing the moment or just, you know, recognizing how fortunate we are to be alive, whether that's for a couple of weeks or, you know, dozens of years.
Yeah.
So that was a fun way to put him in the story.
Yeah. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I had an author named Charles Hood, who wrote a book called Nature at Night, you know, Discovering the Hidden World. And he, in his book, he highlighted a dragonfly that is transoceanic, and that it starts off in India, rides the monsoons to the Maldives, then from there to Africa, and then back, the same. But, you know, because, like you say, their lifespan is so short, it takes several generations in order to complete the cycle. And I thought that was just amazing that,
right,
you know, that's inherent in such a, you know, such a small creature.
Yeah, right, these little things that we don't really think much of. And in fact, the green darner dragonflies, or which Junius is, they also migrate, and maybe not quite as far as the one you were describing, but they do. They will migrate, and sometimes it's generations, between summer and winter grounds.
Pretty
amazing little creatures.
They are. And then if you're writing kind of a mythical style book, dragonflies are a must, you know, for the book.
Yeah.
So then you have a violet green swallow, and then that sail is what's the swallow's name?
I pronounce it Thalassino. People can pronounce it however they want when they're reading. It really doesn't matter. And a lot of these names I actually chose as they're sort of alternates on the scientific name of the creature. So that's why Calliope was named Calliope and so on.
Right.
Yeah. So the swallows, they're beautiful. Of course, everyone loves swallows because they're in big groups and they swoop and they dive and they're just beautiful how they, that's how they eat. They catch insects, you know, on the wing and in big flocks. And I wanted the swallows because they're a big flock bird. And so I wanted to sort of examine some of the dynamics of, you know, life in a flock. And so the swallows kind of, you know, they sort of followed the leader. You know, if the leader told them to do something, that's what they'd all do. And yet, you know, as the plot progressed, some of the younger swallows were like, hey, you know, we don't really agree with that. Maybe we're not going to go along with that. And, you know, so it's just kind of the opportunity to think about how we are in groups and then sometimes how we can, you know, see free of them and change and do things in a different way.
Yeah, that's a great dynamic, you know, to explore the natural world. And then you have Arctos, a grizzly bear. Now, he's definitely a deviation from the birds and the pine. Why did you include a grizzly in this?
Grizzlies, well, they're amazing animals, right? I mean, they're top of the food chain predators. But, you know, at the same time, they are peaceful vegetarians for much of their diet. They eat a lot of pine nuts. So that's kind of one of the reasons I brought them in. In fact, if they don't get enough pine nuts in their diet in the fall, sometimes their hibernation's not so successful and they're not able to bear young because those pine nuts are just so important to, you know, to their diet. And the grizzly bear, you know, the bird, I won't give away plot because it's a, you know, that wouldn't be right. But there's an important task that Arctos performs for her friend, Columbina. They befriend each other. That's an important plot point because Colobina's, you know, she's a small, young bird, and she needed a powerful animal to do something for her.
Mm.
And so that's her friend, Arctos.
Great. So now, when you are going through and developing these characters, was there, you know, any kind of a surprise or, you know, something that you maybe hadn't planned on including one of the characters, or, you know, just something that maybe surprised you just through the actual development of the book, the plot?
There were some surprises because, you know, as a naturalist, I wanted to make these characters realistic. And so I did so much research on their real life qualities, and those affected their personality sometimes. You know, even just like think about a physical body, you know, we're so used to our people bodies, so we know how those work. But, you know, birds were dealing with wings. And feathers. And, you know, so there were some things I wondered about, like, well, you know, can birds feel through their feathers? Do they have a sense of touch?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer turned out to be yes. And, you know, so then some of the characters, some of the bird characters were affectionate. You know, they could actually sort of physically touch each other, smooth down each other's feathers. And, you know, and the senses was another thing. You know, do they smell? How do they see? Like a dragonfly, they've got these crazy eyes, you know, on the top of their head. They can see almost 360 degrees with those eyes.
10,000 lenses. I mean, that's hard to fathom.
It is, you know, being human. So, you know, that's what was the fun about it. And so then, you know, once I had kind of gotten this sort of bedrock of what each species, how they perceived life, how they saw their world, then the fun part, you know, was to have them start to interact. And so they even thought each other's lives were kind of crazy. You know, we might think, hey, that's crazy to be a dragonfly, but, you know, the bear thought it was crazy to be a bird. And, you know, and so they would sort of start comparing their lives, and there was the fact of what they eat. So the nutcrackers, of course, eat nuts, the pine nuts, and the kingfisher eats fish. And so there was a scene in the book where, you know, they can't believe the other one eats what they eat. And so it actually makes a good excerpt. I don't know if this might be a good time. I could do a quick reading.
Yeah. Why don't you do that then, so we can give the listeners, you know, a real clear idea of the book.
Okay. All right. Well, then let me set the stage. So this is Colobina, the nutcracker, and her good friend Halcyon the kingfisher, and they've become good friends. They're such different characters, and the different families don't approve of this friendship because it's a cross-species friendship. But yet they find common ground and they enjoy each other's company. So this is a late one fall afternoon, and they know that they're going to be leaving because winter's coming, so the birds will migrate away and they won't see each other all winter. So they were just enjoying hanging out a little bit one last time. The cones on the pine were quite good, and Colobina immediately set to breaking them with her sharp bill. She had eaten quite a few when she suddenly became aware that Halcyon was eyeing her curiously. She looked up, embarrassed at the dust covering her beak, and said, "Have you never seen me eat before?" He shook his head and gave a loud chortle. "No, Halcyon knows nutcrackers like seeds, but he thought you scratched at them like this," he said, and made a scrabbling movement with his foot. "Oh, no, we peck them. You could never open a cone like that with just your feet." She had a sudden idea. "Here, would you like to try one just once?" She bent forward and let a small brown seed drop from her bill into the cupped claw of her foot, then extended it toward Halcyon. Halcyon made a face and shook his head. "Halcyon could never." "No, you must try. They are good and so nutritious." "Okay, I'll make you a deal. If you will eat a seed, I will eat a fish." Halcyon's eyes shone, and he threw his head back and let out a loud whistling laugh. "Yes, Halcyon will take your deal. Fish also good and so nutritious, you know," he said with a wink. He tentatively reached over and took the seed she offered, holding it between his toes as he inspected it carefully. Then he threw it into his mouth. Colombina watched with amusement as he rolled his eyes and made exaggerated gagging sounds as he swallowed the dry seed down. Finally, he clacked his bill loudly a few times, and then with a smirk pronounced, "Not terrible. Halcyon is a seed eater now." He chuckled softly, rocking lightly on his toes. "Come, let us return to the lake," he said. "You must eat fish now." They flew back together, flapping lazily over the green treetops and up to the lake. Halcyon led the way and took her to his favorite perching spot, a willow with a clear view of the water. The water was cold, but the edges had melted from the day's sunshine, and he knew the place where the fish could not hide from his keen eyes. Colombina stayed behind on the willow and watched. It did not take him long. He found his target and then went into his dive, and she cheered with excitement as he flew back with a small wriggling fish in his bill. "How do I eat that?" she asked, suddenly terrified, as she looked at the dripping wet thing he held out to her. "Whole," he said, his voice muffled, as he held the fish tightly in his bill. "Open up." Colombina closed her eyes and tipped her head back, opening her bill as wide as she could. Suddenly she felt a slippery sensation as he dropped the fish into her open mouth. She gagged, closing her bill, and with an effort swallowed it. It felt slimy as it slid down her throat. Halcyon whistled loudly and laughed. "Ha! Colombina the fish eater! Much tastier than seeds, hmm?" Colombina thrust out her tongue to rid her mouth of the fishy taste and shook her head violently. "That will be the one and only time you will ever see me eat a fish," she said with a smile.
Well, that's a wonderful selection. And your intonation, really kind of personality, emphasizes the personality of each of the characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. They're good friends. I feel like I know them.
Oh, I am sure. So now, who do you think is the target or the reader? Who is it written for?
I think it's pretty clear that those who love nature are going to enjoy this book. And that includes younger readers as well. I mean, even down into, teens, I would say. There are some serious, issues dealing with death and so on that I think younger readers might, might be a little young. But from teens up through adults, I think, people will enjoy it. The interesting thing for me is that I've heard from readers, a number of readers, who don't necessarily call themselves a nature lover, or aren't big outdoors people. And even people that might have been turned off by the idea of it being about talking birds. There's sort of a stigma like, oh, that's like Bambi or, something
right.
childish.
Right.
But in fact, what I've heard from readers is that they really found it engaging and they ended up loving it. And I think, the realism of it, makes them forget that it was about birds and trees.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, sort of relatable characters that you feel like you know and you don't, really get turned off by that. So it's just been fun hearing that feedback from readers, and I'm just so happy that people just enjoy the story for the story.
Yeah. Well, the issues or the situations that are dealt with, in the book via the characters are very much human kinds of challenges as well. But when it's framed as coming from a bird, or a bear, then it's not as, I guess, threatening, or maybe even it opens up to being more acceptable or maybe even more interesting, than if it were humans doing the interaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Things like, working together and cooperation and, family dynamics even, there's siblings in the Nutcracker family that, they fight. And and there's rebellion against adults. And, you know, all these things are very familiar. These are, you know, family friendship issues that, you know, people will relate to, I think.
Yeah, I agree. So what do you think, well, why do you think that there may be, you know, a growing interest in the idea of, you know, perspectives other than the human perspective?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons for that. So, you know, the whole field of animals, I think over the last, I don't know, maybe even 10 years or more, there's just been such a blossoming of understanding on, you know, on our part that so many animals have intelligence and have complex emotions, you know, so we used to think that animals were, you know, just kind of, I don't know, driven by instinct or we would just kind of make them cartoons, you know, and not really learn about them. But now we understand now that, you know, they're capable of feeling, you know, joy and sadness and even things, more complex emotions like, you know, embarrassment or jealousy. And there's been a lot of, you know, it's kind of undeniable now, all the research that's been done showing these different species. And so I think that's the first reason. And then I think the second reason why there's this growing interest in, you know, other perspectives is that there's a real move now toward reconnecting with the natural world. And you know, that relationship had really kind of been broken down over, you know, I don't know, centuries, really. I mean, we live in our houses and, you know, we have running water and we can drive to the store for our food. And,
right.
You know, I think we just forget that we're animals too. And, you know, there's, and especially now, you know, with so many environmental crises, there's a real understanding that we need nature. I mean, it's a literal need, you know, for air and water and soil and plants. We need these things for our physical well-being and our mental health as well.
Yeah, I agree.
So, yeah. And I think you don't even have to, you know, all the labels we put on ourselves these days, you know, you don't have to be a liberal or a tree hugger or anything to care about nature now. You just, you know, just a human living on the planet, because if we save nature, I mean, that's, we're saving ourselves.
Yeah. You know, and it's, I found it interesting over the years, you know, that the idea of environmentalism was very much supposedly a kind of a liberal, left-leaning perspective. And then, gosh, probably about 10 years ago, I had a congressman who was a very view, a right of center view. And, you know, his perspective on the environment was that it was God's creation and that we are in charge of being the, you know, the caretakers of that. And so I really liked seeing that it was the importance of preserving our environment is not a political or, you know, one particular view. I mean, it was all around view.
No, I think that's just such an important point there you're making, Robert. And I've seen that too. You know, so there's the religious sense of stewardship and, you know, Pope Francis talked about that. And, you know, I think it's really becoming more understood through religion, that's one area, but also through other conservation groups. So, you know, so I live part of the year in Idaho, and, you know, that's a very red state, and there's a lot of hunting is a real, like, lifestyle there. And these folks, they love nature, you know, and, you know, whether or not, you know, you choose to be a hunter or whatever, you know, you still go out into the woods and you see animals and, you know, and that enriches our lives. And so it's really, like you say, it's not a political stance. It's just, you know, as I say, it's just a human stance.
Exactly. So, you know, what do you hope that the readers will take away from reading Uplift, other than being uplifted?
I do hope they're uplifted, because I did write Uplift to be a book of hope and about the possibility for change. Because, you know, I think certainly, you know, from a personal standpoint, and so many of us have felt real sadness, you know, whether you call it eco-grief or, you know, sadness, despair about, you know, what's been happening and how much has been lost in the world. But I still want to remind myself and others that, you know, there's still so much beauty and good that's worth saving in the world. You know, something to inspire us and keep us working together to try to fix things. Even when things seem, you know, sort of hopeless, you never want to give up hope. And I think that people will, I think this experience of seeing through another creature's eyes gives people that sort of sense of wonder and a new perspective. I've had many readers talk about, you know, how their eyes were open, and it was a new perspective and seeing nature in a new way. And that is uplifting and hopeful.
Yeah,
so I hope readers will take that from this book.
Yeah, that would be great. Now, I'm a nature photographer, so a lot of times when I'm, you know, photographing particularly creatures, you know, my thoughts go to, you know, what are they kind of thinking about this guy holding something, taking their picture? So,
and a rather talented photographer, I would add. I looked at your work. Beautiful work.
Thank you. But that, you know, kind of takes me out of my, you know, egocentric kind of perspective. And so anyway, that, I think that's helpful when it comes down to understanding and appreciating nature.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, this has really been a treat, Jessica. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yes, I have as well. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest is Jessica Mann. We've been talking about her new novel, Uplift. Oh, I meant to ask, is there going to be a Uplift 2 or Daughters of Columbia?
Oh, yes. Yes, there will. Although it's not a sequel, but yes. So Uplift is the first book of three books, which will be part of the Habitat trilogy. And so Uplift is set in the air, of course. Book two, which I'm working on now, will be set in the ocean.
Wonderful.
So entirely different creatures, whales and sharks and all kinds of amazing things under the water. And then a final book, three, will be set on land.
Land. Wow.
Yeah.
That is a great trilogy. So I look forward to, you know, reading about the next two.
Yeah, thank you. And could I make one last concluding remark?
Sure.
Not sure everyone knows, but so, you know, just reflecting my website, jessicamann.org. So I am essentially a nonprofit. And so I donate profits from the sales of these books to groups that support nature. So I donated to, for example, the White Bark Pine Foundation and a group researching on Clark's Nutcrackers. And so each book, I'm sort of going to be selecting different groups. So, you know, the more books that are out there and sold, I feel like the greater good it can do.
I love that. That's wonderful. That's a wonderful way to give back what nature has given us. And
exactly.
I think every school should have one.
lovely idea.
Have classes, you know, regarding the books. So that'll help.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Again, everyone, you can find out more by visiting Jessica's website, which is jessicamann.org, and that's Jessica, MANN.org. And I want to thank you for joining us for today's edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.